Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program of news and features from around the world is designed for people learning English. We speak a little slowly, using simple sentences and a limited vocabulary. Today on the show, phrasal verb expressions take over our everyday grammar program from Alice Bryant. We close the program, as usual, with a segment of our American history series, The Making of a Nation. Larry West and Steve Ember tell us about the resettlement of the American West following the wars between U.S. government forces and Native American Indians. But first, Susan Shand tells us about a new Princeton student who has been called extraordinary for his educational victory over extreme hardship. Raised in a refugee camp, the young Somali now is planning his studies at the Ivy League school in New Jersey. Here is Susan Shand.
Assad Hussein is a 22-year-old refugee. Last August, he got onto the back of a truck in Dadaab, Kenya. He sat down with other passengers, among food supplies, being driven to Mogadishu, Somalia's capital. The truck went across the desert and deep into an area controlled by supporters of the Al-Shabaab extremist group. On his way to Mogadishu, Hussein got the chance to see where his father grew up. The New York Times newspaper published his story about the ride. Now, Assad Hussein is preparing for another trip. He was recently accepted at one of the world's most famous schools. He is making plans to attend Princeton University in the United States. Assad Hussein was born in Dadaab, one of the world's largest refugee camps, in 1996. His parents and older sister had fled the unrest in Somalia 5 years earlier in search of a new life. Dadaab was meant to be a temporary stop, but became the family's home. In 2005, Hussein's sister, Marianne, immigrated to the United States with her husband and son. It took 11 years for her and her brother to reunite. Hussein told VOA's Somali service that the life in Dadaab is basically stranded. You are not permitted to work or to do anything as a refugee. And the word refugee comes with so many restrictions, he said. Even with those limitations, Hussein said, people had to make lives for themselves. They had escaped war, and they were prepared to keep on going. People told Hussein that one way to a better life was education. He kept the words in mind and has been trying to get into a university for 3 years after finishing high school in 2014. Princeton has been among the U.S. colleges and universities trying to increase the number of students from different ethnic groups. That includes welcoming students with good grades who, like Hussein, may not have enough money to pay for college. Hussein said he has been offered a full scholarship of $70,010 from the university for the next school year. In Princeton's class of 2021, 13% of the students are from outside the United States. They include representatives of 11 African nations. Last month, Princeton's president, Christopher L. Eisgruber, wrote a letter to the university community. He wrote that the school has depended on the talent and contributions of newcomers to this country since it was founded in 1746. Last week, Princeton joined 30 other U.S. colleges and universities in questioning the Trump administration's declaration to restrict immigration from several Muslim-majority countries. A news release said the university gave documents to the U.S. Supreme Court to support the state of Hawaii's case against the restrictions. Ty McCormick is a former Africa editor at Foreign Policy. He invited Hussein to write about President Donald Trump's travel ban after reading his work in The Times. McCormick told VOA Hussein is an extraordinary young man. He wrote that he has learned more things from Hussein than he has from me. Hussein overcame major barriers to get to where he is, while most people can't fully understand these difficulties. My hat is off to him, McCormick said. Hussein wrote about his feelings about living in a refugee camp for Foreign Policy early last year. The words I write may travel all around the world, but I am confined to the refugee camp where I was born. I can't move freely in Kenya. I need a permit to leave Dadaab. My whole life, it seems, I've been living the American dream. I just don't know how much longer I can bear to live it outside of America. Hussein hopes his success will change people's minds about what refugees can do. When we hear of refugees, we always think of people who want something, he told VOA. So I'm glad that my story shows that refugees are actually people who can do something. Now, Hussein will be going to the same U.S. school that produced theoretical physicist Richard Feynman, former President Woodrow Wilson, and First Lady Michelle Obama. Hussein says he wants to study English and history, and for the first time since he was 9 years old, he will live in the same country as his parents and sister. I'm Susan Shand.
In past Everyday Grammar programs, we have told you about phrasal verbs. A phrasal verb is a group of words that act as a verb. It is made from a verb and a preposition, adverb, or both. In the 1957 Calypso song, Angelico, American singer, actor, and activist Harry Belafonte sings about colonization.
Your mama got to take you back, Angelico, Angelico, teach you all the things you lack.
He uses the phrasal verb take back in the line, your mama got to take you back. In this line, the verb means to accept or receive someone or something again. Phrasal verbs make up a large part of everyday spoken and written English. This means they can easily be found in news, music, film, and so many other places. On today's program, we will talk about phrasal verbs that include the word take, one of the most widely used verbs in English. There are more than a dozen phrasal verbs with take, and some of them have more than one meaning. Let's start by taking another look at take back. Like some other phrasal verbs, take back has many meanings. We will not learn all of them today. Here is the line again from Angelico. Your mama got to take you back. Notice that the words take and back are separated by the object pronoun you. Some phrasal verbs are separable, meaning they can be separated by the object, but some are not. The verb take back is separable. In addition, with some phrasal verbs, such as take back, you always separate them when using the object pronouns me, you, her, him, and it. For example, we could not say, your mama got to take back you. The you must go between take and back. Now let's move to take after. This is a quick and easy one because it has just one meaning, to look like or be like someone, especially a parent or other family member. Listen to an example. Everyone tells me that I take after my grandmother, but I don't think we are that much alike. Take after is not separable. You cannot say, for example, I take my grandmother after. Our next verb is take over. One of its meanings is to take control of something. Listen to pop singer Kelly Rowland sing about love taking control of a person in the song When Love Takes Over. Take over is separable. In the song, the line implies that love is taking over you. Here's how you might say those. When love takes you over, or when love takes over you. Like many phrasal verbs, take over can also function as a noun. When this happens, it becomes one word. For instance, you could say, the company takeover happened last August. Now let's talk about take off. According to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, it has 10 meanings. For this program, we will look at two of them. One meaning is useful when traveling. It means to begin to fly. For this meaning, the verb is inseparable. For example, in an airplane, you might hear this. Be sure your seatbelts are fastened. We will be taking off in a few minutes. Take off can also act as a noun. When this happens, it also becomes one word. For example, you might hear the pilot say, flight attendants, prepare for takeoff. Another meaning of takeoff is to remove something. For this meaning, English speakers actually use takeoff far more often than the verb remove. In a song by American hip-hop group OutKast, and singer Norah Jones, Jones tells her partner to be his true self instead of trying to be cool.
Baby, take off your cool. I wanna see you. I wanna see you.
Because this meaning of take off is separable, the line could have also been said this way. Baby, take your cool off. Our last verb for today is take out. One meaning of this verb is to go with someone to an event, restaurant, or some other place or activity and pay for the bill. The words take and out are usually separated for this meaning. For example, my sister took me out for dinner for my birthday. This usage of take out can also mean that two people who are romantically interested in each other are going out somewhere. Listen, he took me out to a wine festival We had an amazing time. Take out as one word is the noun form. It means food that you buy from a restaurant and take home to eat. There are hundreds of English phrasal verbs, so it is not very effective to try to memorize them from a long list. But there are methods you can use. Music is one of the best ways to learn a language. If you want to try to learn phrasal verbs through music, first decide which ones you'd like to learn. Then search for them on a music lyrics website, such as lyrics.com. Next, choose and listen to the songs. Another method is to write a short story using some of the verbs you want to remember. For example, my father is a great cook. He says I take after him because everybody loves my food. So he asked me to take over the family restaurant. I do like cooking, but I prefer when my family takes me out to eat. Afterward, you can record your story on your mobile phone and listen to it as often as you like. Join us again soon for more phrasal verbs. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the late 1800s, white Americans expanded their settlements in the western part of the country. They claimed land traditionally used by American Indians. The Indians were hunters, and they struggled to keep control of their hunting lands. The federal government supported the settlers' claims. It fought and won several wars with Indian tribes. It forced the Indians to live on government-controlled reservations. Larry West and Steve Ember tell about the people who settled on the old Indian lands after the wars.
After the Indians were defeated, thousands of settlers hurried west. Some hoped to find new, rich farmland. The soil they left behind was thin and overworked. Their crops were poor. Some simply hoped to buy any kind of farmland. They did not have enough money to buy farmland in the East. Others came from other countries and hoped to build new lives in the United States. All the settlers found it easy to get land in the West. In 1862, Congress had passed the Homestead Act. This law gave every citizen and every foreigner who asked for citizenship the right to claim government land. The law said each man could have 65 hectares. If he built a home on the land and farmed it for 5 years, it would be his. He paid just $10 to record the deal.
Claiming land on the Great Plains was easy. Building a farm there and working it was not so easy. The wide, flat grasslands seemed strange to men who had lived among the hills and forests of the East. Here there were few hills or trees. Without trees, settlers had no wood to build houses. Some built houses partly underground. Others built houses from blocks of earth cut out of the grassland. These houses were dark and dirty. They leaked and became muddy when it rained. There were no fences on the Great Plains, so it was hard to keep animals away from crops.
Settlers in the American West also had a problem faced by many people in the world today. They had little fuel for heating and cooking. With few trees to cut for fuel, they collected whatever they could find. Small woody plants, dried grass, cattle and buffalo wastes. Water was hard to find, too. And although the land seemed rich, it was difficult to prepare for planting. The grass roots were thick and strong. They did not break apart easily. The weather also was a problem. Sometimes months would pass without rain, and the crops would die. Winters were bitterly cold.
Most of the settlers, however, were strong people. They did not expect an easy life. And as time passed, they found solutions to most of the problems of farming on the Great Plains. Railroads were built across the West. They brought wood for homes, wood and coal for fuel. Technology solved many of the problems. New equipment was invented for digging deep wells. Better pumps were built to raise the water to the surface. Some of the pumps used windmills for power.
The fence problem was solved in 1874. That was the year barbed wire was invented. The sharp metal barbs tore the skin of the men who stretched it along fence tops, but they prevented cattle from pushing over the fences and destroying crops. New farm equipment was invented. This included a plow that could break up the grassland of the plains. And farmers learned techniques for farming in dry weather.
Most of the problems on the plains could be solved, but solving them cost money. A farmer could get wood to build his house, but he had to buy the wood and pay the railroad to bring it west. To farm the plains, he needed barbed wire for fences and plows and other new equipment. All these things cost money. So a plains farmer had to grow crops that were in big demand. He usually put all his efforts into producing just one or two crops.
The farmers of the plains did well at first. There was enough rain. Huge crops of wheat and corn were produced. Much of the grain was sold in Europe, and farmers got good prices. The farmers, however, were not satisfied. They were angry about several things. One was the high cost of sending their crops to market. The only way to transport their grain was by railroad, and railroad prices were very high for farm products, higher than for anything else. The railroads also owned the big buildings where grain was stored. Farmers had to pay to keep their grain there until it was sold. They said storage costs were too high.
The farmers were angry about the high cost of borrowing money, too. They opposed the import taxes, tariffs they had to pay on foreign products. Some of the tariffs were as high as 60%. Congress had set the levels high to protect American industry from foreign competition. But farmers said they were the victims of this policy because it increased their costs. Farmers as individuals could do nothing to change the situation. But if they united in a group, they thought, perhaps they could influence government policy.
Farmers began to unite in local, social, and cultural groups called Granges. As more and more farmers joined Granges, the groups began to act on economic problems. Farmers organized cooperatives to buy equipment and supplies in large amounts directly from factories. The cost of goods was lower when bought in large amounts. The Granges also began to organize for political action. Local Granges became part of the National Grange Movement. Grange supporters won control of state legislatures in a number of Middle Western states. They passed laws to limit the cost of railroad transportation and crop storage. Railroads refused to obey these laws. They fought the measures in the courts. They did not win. Finally, they appealed to the United States Supreme Court.
The railroads said the laws were not constitutional because they interfered with the right of Congress to control trade between the states. The railroads said states could not control transportation costs. To do so would reduce profits for the railroad. And that would be the same as taking property from the railroad without legal approval. The Supreme Court rejected this argument. In a decision in 1876, the Supreme Court said states had a legal right to control costs of railroad transportation. It said owners of property in which the public has an interest must accept public control for the common good. The farmers seemed to have won, but the powerful railroad companies continued to struggle against controls. They reduced some transportation costs, but only after long court fights.
The Granges tried to get Congress to pass laws giving the federal government power to control the railroads. Congress refused to act. Many farmers lost hope that the Granges could force the railroads to make any real cuts in their costs. They began to leave the organization. Others left because the economy had improved. They no longer felt a need to protest. Within a few years, the National Grange had lost most of its members. Some local groups continued to meet, but they took no part in politics. New protest groups would be formed in a few years when farmers once again faced hard times. But for now, in the late 1870s, times were good. Most people were satisfied.
We have come to the end of today's show. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Hope you return too. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.